I'm going to call to order the House Committee on Energy and Environment, and I'm going to reopen the public hearing on HB 2020 and invite forward Gary Bauer, Paul Romaine, and Ted Case, and Varner Seaman. Get you another.
I guess
that's
if you
what
want
you,
to.
That's what you checked. Do you think you're all capable of testifying in 3 minutes or less?
Each?
Total.
No, I.
30 seconds?
We got. I think
sure,
I'm gonna,
I'll go ahead and start then.
Yeah, I'm going to put everybody on the clock today, if you don't mind, and try to get done in 3 minutes. We appreciate it.
Sure. Yeah, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric. I think my comments, I'm here today testifying opposed to House Bill 2020. Three minutes of input is an ironic thing to say before this, because I think we're pretty concerned about this bill really being an effort to shut out utility and industry input when we look at some of the conversations that are going on in front of our state right now. First, I want to say PG has a pretty solid track record of engaging in carbon reduction efforts and carbon reduction conversations, including things like our early closure of the Boardman coal plant, which is first in the nation, and our support for Senate Bill 1547, which passed last year, which brings a ban on coal power to the state of Oregon, as well as moves to 50% renewable energy. And we testified, I testified in front of this committee last year and pushed pretty hard on that after we had what I thought was a pretty collaborative conversation with environmental stakeholders. We're opposed to this bill today, and I'll go through some of the specifics about why that is. And I think a big part of that is we're not exactly sure why under this bill we're being asked to remove ourselves from some of the serious policy work in terms of the future of energy going forward. And just to put it bluntly, we're somewhat indignant about the approach around this bill. First, we just want to note that this bill comes out of a work group that was started last summer around the Department of Energy. At that point, the Senate President and his comments, along with the Speaker, to put together that oversight work group, the Senate President and his comments said, should it even exist? And now we're in a position where we're greatly expanding the Department of Energy, and we're greatly expanding what the scope of its duties are, as well as potentially greatly expanding the cost to utility customers of administering this this department. We're concerned further around the process of developing this bill, around conversations that did occur and conversations, more importantly, that did not occur to stakeholders of the Department of Energy in putting forward this bill. I think in particular we're concerned that we didn't have very much of a heads up that this was a preferred approach by some members of the legislature or the Department of Energy. We were a little bit stunned to hear from Mike Kaplan that the Department of Energy was supporting this bill last week in the hearing, especially when we had to sit down at our offices with Mike and with Janine Benner of the department recently this month to talk about the future of the Department of Energy and our relationship. We thought that this would have come up. So that puts us in a place where we're not particularly excited about how we got to this point in the conversation. So let me go through a couple of the things that cause us particular concern in this bill. First, in Section 1, Sub 2, Sub B, there's language that says the development of energy resources should be accomplished consistent with the state's GHG reduction goal. I'll conclude my comments with that. But let me just say we're extremely concerned about the process or lack of process, lack of conversation around this bill, which is a pretty significant change to energy policy and energy structures in the state. And to have 3 minutes on this is, I got to say, extremely frustrating. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Holm, members of the committee. I'm Gary Bauer, Northwest Natural. I'll start by saying that we do appreciate the work that Senator Baia and Representative Polley did undertake with the task force and the rest of the people that participated in that. It was a lot of time spent. However, we also think the work was just that was undertaken was just kind of the beginning of the discussion. The task force had very limited discussions on the future of the agency and never did reach any kind of a consensus among its members. As the task force heard in testimony during the interim, one of the major problems facing the agency was over the years, and this has been a 30-plus year agency, programs, tasks were assigned to that agency without reviewing how they would fit in both with current programs as well as the staff capabilities. We're concerned that this may happen again with the adoption of House Bill 2020. It adds considerable work in the area of climate. We believe that climate change involves more than energy. And I think you've heard that repeatedly throughout this session as well as in previous sessions. The Department of Environmental Quality is already addressing climate issues and is building up its staff in this area. They're responsible for the low carbon fuel standard. They've done the climate analysis that the legislature directed them to do, and they're responsible for collecting all of the data on the emissions that we provide to them. We think it would be duplicative to add this role now to the Department of Energy. The department, and Mr. Kaplan in particular, has worked hard over the last couple of years to address the problems that the agency has had, many of which, again, were the result of adding these problems piecemeal and programs piecemeal to the agency. Again, as Mr. Seaman said, when the presiding officers formed the task force, they asked whether or not the agency even needed to be continued. Northwest Natural believes the agency does need to be continued, but we'd like to see how well it can function now that it's getting its act cleaned up going forward before you add a lot more to it. Thank you.
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. Appreciate the opportunity to comment on House Bill 2020. We are also opposed to this bill. I do also want to commend Representative Holby for his work on the ODO Oversights Committee and all those that served on it. We do know a whole lot more about the department than we did before. But until recently, most electric cooperatives had very little relationship with ODO, if any at all, other than sending in our energy supplier assessment check, which has continued to go up dramatically over the years. So we did something in the past year or so. We attempted to do our own examination of ODO. Is what's the value proposition for us? What do they do for us for the money that we spend on them, which is over $250,000 a year? So we undertook a series of meetings with Director Kaplan and his team to review the value proposition. It's not been easy. We have our own energy efficiency programs through Bonneville and our own. We have our own unique power supply with Bonneville, which I don't think they fully understand. So the nexus has been very hard to find. And so we view House Bill 2020 through the prism of how do we continue to build upon this relationship, particularly for rural Oregonians and consumer-owned utilities. And after reviewing this legislation, we think that House Bill 2020 moves this relationship in the wrong direction. I'll just give you a couple examples why. We've looked at the criteria for serving on the Oversight and Advisory Board, and as the board is currently constructed, we have no confidence that the voices of rural Oregon will be heard. In addition, we are also very interested in the department's new focus on climate policy. Oregon's electric cooperatives are approximately 95% carbon-free because our reliance on federal hydropower. Our frustration with the state of Oregon, and I guess extension ODO, is that the state's position on the operation of the Columbia River Power System and the federal dams has been completely turned over to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And for years, ODF&W has advocated a risky plan to spill more water over the dams for fish, and we know that it will cost BPA customers $40 million a year and $7 million for the co-ops that are on this panel today. We also know that the plan will cause 840,000 metric tons of carbon to be emitted because the replacement power will have to come from fossil fuel generation. But there's been no leadership from ODO on this, and for those that have been advocating for the state to be a leader in climate change, the Global Warming Commission says we're lagging behind our carbon goals. But where is the outrage for emitting 840,000 tons of carbon for a dubious plan for fish? So we have absolutely no confidence that this new reconfigured ODO will address the state's conflicting policy when it comes to carbon or protect consumers. We urge the committee to oppose the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney with the Romaine Group, and I'm here representing the Oregon People's Utility Districts Association. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the energy supplier assessment, which is really the backbone of this agency. Without this, the agency really doesn't exist because you don't give it any money. And the problem is the ESA was created in 1971 as a very narrow purpose fee to identify sites for nuclear power plants in Oregon. It's since grown to become a general revenue source, a tax, to support staffing and general functions of the Department of Energy, the governor's office, pay Otto's rent, litigation fees, and I'll get to that in a second, and build their ending funds fund balance. It's charged to energy suppliers as defined in statute and used by Otto as a tax, but one without the normal oversight and normal procedure for the tax. It's grown at an excessive rate. For example, in 2015-17 budget, ESA rate payers received a post-session surprise exponential increase in their bills with an average 40 to 50% increase from 2014. There's additional increase projected for the next biennium. We filed suit along with other consumer-owned utilities. That suit right now is in Marion County Circuit Court, and it's a broad group of energy resource suppliers. We're seeking a judicial opinion that the ESA is indeed a tax and accordingly must meet all constitutional requirements and to be imposed. In fact, in 1982, the predecessor statute to this particular statute, the ESA, was declared a tax by the Oregon Supreme Court. It dealt with the issue of whether the revenue raised had to go to the common school fund or could go to the general fund. And because it was an assessment on the sale of natural gas and oil, it had to be changed. The legislature then changed it to a tax on gross revenue. But something funny happened in 1999, effective in 2000. The Constitution was again amended so that any tax, and I emphasize tax, on the sale of motor vehicle fuel or anything used for propulsion of a vehicle had to go to roads. And so what you found is that Otto stopped assessing the fuel suppliers for this tax. If it was a fee, it could be assessed, but it's a tax, and even Otto, in their own actions, admitted that. We're also seeking an opinion that Otto did not follow proper statutory procedure when assessing the tax. In 2013, the Oregon legislature, some of you, actually passed a law to ensure a transparent process, and Otto has failed to meet with that process. Utility customers should receive value for payments they make, and Otto should be required to follow procedures set out in statute, especially in this case where they personally negotiated and agreed to the statutory changes. The bottom line here is if this funding goes away, you have an issue with the existing Department of Energy, and you have a huge issue going forward if you try to expand this on the back of the energy supplier assessment. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Paul, thanks for your testimony there. So what you're saying is that the ESA as it currently exists could be in some jeopardy, but also any additional ODO, let's just say FTE or program expansion, would also be in danger of being funded properly. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, at some point, I don't know if we want to call Mike Kaplan back up, but it might be nice to have him address this in our testimony.
Yes, I was looking for Mike. Any further questions? Okay, there he goes. Any further questions?
He's going to wait till the end.
Okay. We're pretty clear. Very good. We've got, and we had invited Director Kaplan to come up at the end of the panels today to answer questions. So
great. Thank you.
And I'll invite Angus Duncan, Janet Gastelum, Meredith Conley, and Samuel Pastrick. Go right ahead whenever you're ready. Okay. Meredith here. Go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Angus Duncan. I am president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, and I chair the Oregon Global Warming Commission. And in supporting House Bill 2020, I am taking the rather unusual step for a commission chair of recommending the dissolution of my own commission. I need to explain why, if I can. The first reason is that the state's climate challenges require a more coherent, supported response, including cost-effective sector-by-sector emissions reduction analysis, including adaptation and preparation, planning, including communications and and education with and for concerned Oregonians. Because while there is a state roadmap adopted and developed adopted by my commission, there is no agency accountability to implementing any part of that roadmap, and there isn't any other systematic multi-agency strategy. There are authorities, there are actions scattered across state agencies, but they are not linked and they are not coherent. And finally, because the Oregon Global Warming Commission, as committed as we all are to succeeding, you know, we have ample scope, but we don't have the authority. We have limited bandwidth. We have few resources. We have few tools. You've heard all of this before. House Bill 2020, with some modest revisions, could effectively address this absence. So could accommodation of Senator Byers' Senate Bill 908 and Representative Powers' House Bill 3269. In considering the choices before you, I encourage you to ask and answer these four questions. First, with respect to scope, will the outcome effectively address emissions reduction? Will it affect greenhouse gas uptake and sequestration in Oregon's forests and grasslands? Will it address adaptation and preparation across all state agencies? Acknowledging that that energy is the source of roughly 80% of greenhouse gas emissions, that still leaves an important additional 20% that need to be addressed. It leaves adaptation and preparation, which need to be addressed. So if this is going to be lodged with a Department of Energy and Climate, we need to ensure that the scope and authority of that department is sufficient to encompass all of those considerations. And if we're not, then we need to ensure that the department has its authority and responsibilities and that you empower the Global Warming Commission with sufficient authority and tools so that we can do our job. The second is, will you provide the commission with those tools? And I guess here I would encourage a commission for energy and climate to have not advisory authority, but policymaking and budget authority over the Department of Energy and an accountability relationship with other state agencies, but not authority over them. Third, will there be a capacity for the kind of fact-based analysis that can apply both the science and cost-effectiveness analysis to refining the state's strategies? And fourth, is the commission makeup going to be broad enough to represent both interested stakeholders and the public interest at large? And here I would encourage you to consider, instead of defining individual slots on this commission, to define in a paragraph the kinds of experience and skills you'd like to have on the commission, but leave, you know, flexibility to the governor to make those appointments. I think the bills for you this session will benefit from some minor surgery to address some of these questions, and I'm obviously happy to work with you and with staff to get there. In particular, and finally, I urge the committee to take up the language in Representative Powers' bill that creates agency accountability for the state's climate agenda while respecting the existing agency decision-making processes. Thank you.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Jana Gastelum. I'm the Climate Program Director at the Oregon Environmental Council. First, we would like to commend the interim working group for all the hard work that was done looking at the agency. Similarly, we appreciate the work of the agency leadership and staff in providing a lot of information. I know a lot of good thinking has gone into looking at the Department of Energy. We support HB 2020. We are looking at this opportunity. We're here at a crossroads. There's an opportunity to really reimagine what the Department of Energy can be. And by enhancing and expanding its mission to include climate change, since energy and climate are inextricably linked, this is a really new opportunity and great chance for Oregon to really chart a new course. We've really been aided by the work of the Global Warming Commission. We believe that if climate isn't fully incorporated into the Department of Energy, then certainly a bill like what Representative Powert has put forward should be taking on instead. We need resources, we need staff, and we need the data and all the tools that are needed to really move a climate and energy strategy forward in our state. There's a lot of great work that has been done, but it would be very helpful to have the analysis that I think you legislators are always looking for housed in an agency that you can go to. And we really support the idea of having a well-defined and resourced interagency working group, as Angus noted, that can really collaborate, find where there are those points of synergy between agencies, and be able to really think strategically as Oregon moves forward with energy policy. I think I will leave it there for now. I know you guys have a very busy agenda ahead of you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm, Vice Chairs Power and Johnson, committee members. My name is Sam Pastrick. I'm a consumer advocate with the Oregon Citizens Utility Board, or CUB, as you guys probably better know us. I'll try to zip through my comments here pretty quickly. So I'm here today to express our support for House Bill 2020. CUB, as you know, is a statewide advocacy organization for residential customers of investor-owned utilities and investor-owned energy and telecommunications utilities. We intervene on behalf of ratepayers before the Oregon PUC and represent the interests of residential customers before you all in the legislature. First, I want to echo previous comments highlighting the importance of integrating the idea of climate to reinforce that connection with a reformed Department of Energy and Climate. However, I do want to focus my comments on the proposed Oregon Energy and Climate Board with 2 points about its composition and 1 point regarding its function. So Provision 4 in Section 3, I wanted to point out, achieves, I think, an important good governance goal of really avoiding undue conflicts of interest. We highlight this vital provision with the hope that it's reinforced as work on the bill continues. CUB also wants to applaud Provision 3C in Section 3 due to our focus on advocacy for residential utility ratepayers. And though we, of course, work a great deal in the legislature, perhaps most of our influence plays out at the PUC in a regulatory setting. Therefore, ensuring a residential energy user presence on the Oregon Energy and Climate Board to advise an agency like a reformed Department of Energy and Climate that has the ability to influence state utility regulation but is even more influential in statewide energy policy and use of general fund dollars would certainly complement our efforts. More generally, I'd like to highlight that representing everyday Oregonians is a critical element to this board's composition. Shifting to the last point about function, CUB believes that really the proposed bill gets it right in that the Oregon Energy and Climate Board would operate better as an advisory role. This, we believe, is an important feature to the bill and one that should remain as it advances. Thanks for your time, and please allow me to reinforce our support for House Bill 2020.
Thank you all. Any questions for this panel? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For CUB, I guess I've got to admit I'm not understanding this from the ratepayers' perspective. What in this bill would give ratepayers across the state of Oregon assurance that the future is going to be have their best interest in mind and not other special interests?
Well, I think that's why we wanted to highlight the advisory board. That was really sort of the focus of our interest in the bill. There are lots of strong components to it, but the addition to a, you know, I guess I have the wording directly in front of me, but the addition to a permanent seat that's intended to represent the interests of residential customers, I think we would argue would reinforce.
And the follow-up would be, I guess, it's at the bottom of page one where it says that development of energy resources be accomplished consistent with greenhouse gas reduction goals. I don't find anything in there that's from the ratepayer standpoint that their interests and their outcomes are first and foremost. It's related to GHG greenhouse gas goals. I'm not quibbling with that or saying that that's incorrect, but I just don't find protections for ratepayers in there, so I'll just let it go. Could I have a question with Angus also, please?
Yes.
Angus, you've been in front of our committee multiple times and angling for a little bit of additional support. I think we've all heard
just
that.
Just a little bit.
But I didn't hear you asking for a whole agency to run. Is that correct? I guess my question would be, and now that you're asking also in addition to what's in the bill, asking for policy making and budget authority as well, where do you have the qualifications and track record to where we should give you the keys to ODO?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, well, we won't regard that as a hand grenade of a question, but I will answer it in a couple of different ways. Number one, I wasn't assuming or expecting that I would end up being even on this new commission, let alone chairing it and in charge of things. Number two, I actually have had some experience in managing a budget and in overseeing a much larger budget. But this isn't presumably about me. It is about what would be a reasonable and logical way for a commission like this to operate with a department like the Department of Energy. And I am assuming it would be and should be similar to the way, for example, the Transportation Commission operates with the Department of Transportation or the EQC with the Department of Environmental Quality. In none of those cases is there a presumption that the members of the commission will have executive or budget or large organizational management experience. They're there for policymaking. And that's what I am assuming that this commission will also be focused on.
One just clarifying question, Mr. Chair. There isn't a referral to Ways and Means of this bill. Should there not be if we're talking about FTE and additional program?
Mr. Sharon, Vice Chair Johnson, there's currently was not a subsequent referral, and I have not requested a fiscal on the bill. So I haven't been in communication with LFO on the bill yet.
You'll be communicating with LFO at some point, I assume.
The committee.
Thank you.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Angus, this question is not a hand grenade, but I served on the committee, and I couldn't support the committee has spent the year last year looking at this situation. I couldn't support the combination of climate with energy. And the reason was I kind of wanted to make sure our lights stay on in the state. I really couldn't see that particular mission being convoluted with such a complex and serious matter as climate. And I'm just asking you, if you were in charge and it came down to it, and you couldn't make accommodation for both, which would you favor?
I mean, Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, which would I favor of the two pathways that I described going forward?
No, I'm giving you a choice here. You can come down on the side of keeping the lights on or come down on the side of the climate. Because remember, it's really difficult for one person to serve two masters, and that's what this bill suggests. So I'm putting you in that position. You obviously are in favor of climate. I assume your answer is going to be you're going to come down in favor of the climate, and the lights will take second base or not. Tell me why I'm wrong. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bent, so thank you for that non-hand grenade of a question. I think the answer is the answer that we have certainly passed back and forth between us on many occasions, which is that the state government has lots of contradictory priorities that have to be reconciled, and we have to reconcile reducing greenhouse gases and preparing for climate with keeping the lights on. I am entirely of the belief that we can do both of those, and I don't think we will end up in a position where we have to choose from one or the other. And honestly, I remember this would be about 25 years ago when we were pitched much the same sort of unreal choice between saving energy and keeping the lights on. And we insisted that there wasn't a contradiction between those two, that they aligned and could be aligned. And in fact, they have been over the last 25 or 30 years. Climate, we have to deal with reducing our greenhouse gases. You have been among the strongest voices in insisting we also have to prepare and adapt so that we can deal with the changes that a changing climate is going to bring to us. We have to do all of those things. And I don't find a contradiction between the two.
Just one, please.
I thank you, Mr. Chair. I fear that if I ask Angus another question, it may be longer than just the 30 seconds you want me to. So I'll not ask a question, but thank you, Angus, for your answer.
I really need to move on if we can. So I'm going to thank this panel for your input today, and I'm going to call the final panel. Rhett Lawrence, Wendy Gerlitz, Nels Johnson, and Claudia Keith. Go right ahead when you're ready.
Thank you.
Why don't you go ahead?
Lana, if you want to come on up, I think we got a spot for you.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm and members of the committee. My name is Nels Johnson. I'm here on behalf of Renewable Northwest today. And we are here and we're pleased to support House Bill 2020. The department fills a crucial role in the study and design and implementation of renewable energy policies in Oregon and is uniquely qualified and positioned to help the state achieve its energy climate goals. And given the strong correlation between climate and energy, we support House Bill 2020's aim to better link energy generation and consumption with the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals. We're supportive of this bill. We have a couple friendly amendments we think could make it even stronger, in particular as it pertains to the Climate Board, the Oregon Energy and Climate Board, creating two positions for members of the Institution of Higher Education in Oregon with expertise in energy and climate issues, one expert in climate and one expert in energy. Just think that might provide greater clarification. Second is better clarification regarding members with expertise in transportation issues, perhaps something as simple as transportation issues related to climate or energy. And finally, possibly adding one to two members at large who can represent the governor's objectives as the state moves forward towards its energy policy and greenhouse gas reduction goals. But with that, we are in support of the bill, and we appreciate your time and happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christine Everts, representing the Northwest Energy Coalition, testifying in place of Wendy Gerlitz today, and we would like to register our support for House Bill 2020. The Northwest Energy Coalition is an alliance of nearly 100 environmental, civic, and human services organizations, progressive utilities, and businesses in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana, and British Columbia. We promote development of renewable energy and energy conservation, consumer protection, low-income energy assistance, and fish and wildlife restoration on the Columbia and Snake Rivers. A well-functioning Department of Energy is essential to effectively plan for and manage statewide energy concerns. The scope of activity encompassed in the energy field is not only critical to the future of our state, but also is a field that's rapidly changing as technologies and markets evolve with increasing speed. This underscores the need to have a strong, knowledgeable statewide agency that can provide information, planning, and other support to the legislature and the governor, other agencies, and stakeholders and citizens. House Bill 2020 takes important steps toward restructuring the organization and critical work of the agency to guide statewide energy matters in an effective and efficient manner. The inclusion of a focus on climate change is critical. The energy sector is a key contributor to greenhouse gas emission in Oregon, and thus an important part of climate solutions, mitigation, and adaptation efforts. We especially support the Interagency Climate Coordinating Committee called for in this bill, and coordination among agencies is essential to effective and efficient information and action on climate-related matters. The Northwest Energy Coalition looks forward to engaging in discussions around the specific components of this bill and providing additional input on other related bills concerning the future of the Oregon Department of Energy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we urge your support of House Bill 2020.
Chair Helm and committee members. I'm Claudia Keith, speaking for the League of Women Voters, testifying with comments on House Bill 2020, topic related to updating Oregon Department of Energy roles and responsibilities. Please refer to our written testimony posted on OLIS last March the 20th. Our House Bill 2020 testimony is consistent with the League's and national positions to preserve physical, chemical, and biological integrity of the ecosystem, with a focus on demanding pollution prevention, ensuring justice and public safety for all people, and the League's Amici standing supporting our Children's Trust state and federal lawsuits relating to the public trust doctrine and a new fundamental right to a safe climate. The League supports appropriate efforts to change state organizational structure and framework to better address and manage climate change mitigation and adaptation prioritized goals. In general, we are pleased that both the House and the Senate have several bills proposing approaches to address how best to strengthen the Oregon Global Warming Commission with the support of the Department of Energy to ensure optimized funding and coordination and management of the Oregon climate policy. We encourage the process to begin in 2017 and to be complete no later than early 2018. This testimony recognizes that the greatest environmental, moral challenge facing us at this time is climate disruption. There is an urgency, according to current science, to reduce net greenhouse gas emissions fast enough to avoid serious damage to the global climate ecosystem. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm here on behalf of the Pacific Propane Gas Association. We followed the Energy Oversight Committee during the interim faithfully, and I'm here not to talk about the contents of House Bill 2020, but a possible amendment that we may bring. The propane dealers are having an issue with how the Department of Energy bills the energy supplier assessment. They only bill utilities on one level, but they're billing propane on several levels, and they're also billing for things other than energy. We have since talked to Mike Kaplan, of the director of ODO, and he's going to meet with us in a couple weeks. But if he cannot, because the way the statute is worded, if he cannot fix our problem internally and needs some legislation, then we may come to you and ask for an amendment. I just wanted to make you aware.
Thank you all for your testimony today. We appreciate it.
Next question.
Oh, hold on.
Sorry.
Representative Rocksmith.
Thank you. I appreciate the testimony as well. I tried to get a question in for Angus earlier, but couldn't get that in. So maybe you can answer it. We're talking about, you know, I don't think anybody in this room disagrees that climate change is occurring. I think we disagree on why and how and what contributes to it, and also what reductions will do. So my question is, in regards to greenhouse gases, since we are talking about the global scale whenever we're talking about climate emissions and climate change, what is Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions compared to percentage compared to the global scale?
If you don't know, we can ask Director Kaplan, who's coming up.
Next. Yeah, Chair Helm, Representative Brocksmith. I think that Angus or Director Kaplan probably better equipped to answer that question than I am.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And I'll invite Director Kaplan up just for a couple minutes. I apologize to everybody for sort of cracking the whip here, but we've got another two agencies here to give presentations, and I need to get through that and some work sessions today. So I apologize for the packed schedule, but we just have to get it done. Welcome. And why don't we start with Representative Johnson had a question that he had hoped to answer, and Representative Rocksmith had a question. To introduce yourself and see about answering those questions, and then let us know anything else in about 5 minutes in response to the testimony you've heard if you have concerns.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Kaplan, Director of the Oregon Department of Energy. We testified last time, so I won't waste any time sort of going over that. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have from the panels. Representative Johnson, I know yours related to ESA, but But specifically, I didn't write it down. I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you being here. Yeah, the question came up about the ESA, about the legal framework that it stands on. Apparently, there's litigation underway right now. I'm guessing you're aware of that. And how dependent upon a favorable outcome to that litigation, or is the agency relying to actually be able to fund and or pay for the expansion of the agency that's being requested in this bill?
Chair Helm, members of the committee, Representative Johnson, we're actually at a very unique point in time for the Department of Energy. We are expecting our tax credit programs to sunset at the end of this session. We're expecting our small-scale energy loan program to move to another agency, and a variety of other incentive programs that we have with the agency of a much smaller stature that we expect to move. With that, we are able to, now is the time to reframe the agency. We will have some additional operating revenue, some additional FTE. Ultimately, this bill asks for, from the Department of Energy, something relatively modest, which is to stand up an advisory board, to staff that board, and then to work for the next couple of years, or however long the timeline ultimately ends up being, and make recommendations to the 19 legislature about the evaluation of how climate policy and programs are structured in the state, and then bring that debate to you for the future. So for us, it's not a massive expansion of our size of our staff. It certainly is a different direction, an additional direction for the mission and scope of the agency moving well into the future. That's true.
Follow up. So if the ESA is found to be a tax and not a fee, and we're able to go through proper mechanisms to actually accomplish that, what would you rely upon then for funding these FTE?
You
have other sources that will cover that for you?
Chair Helm, members of the committee, Representative Johnson, if it's true that the statutory construction of the ESA is a tax, not a fee, that is I don't mean to be flippant, that would be a question we would have to bring back to the legislature to weigh in with the responsibilities that we currently have. It would be totally premature for me to guess what that might be.
Thank you.
And Representative Brock Smith had same question.
Now I have more.
I'd appreciate if we could get through them very
understood.
Quickly. Making the direction.
So you spoke about reorganizing different dollars with regards to expiring tax credits to fund this new part of the agency. How many millions are we talking about?
Chair Helm, members of the committee, Representative Brock Smith. I'm not sure we're even talking about a million in terms of what the additional responsibility would be. We envision 2 or 3 FTE to complete this work and staff the new advisory board. In terms of the millions of the responsibility that we will no longer have, the small-scale energy loan program is a $190 million portfolio currently. Not all of that is in our budget, obviously, but the bonding work that we do on that is, by and large, we would go from a $180 million budget to a $40 million biennial budget, so about $20 million per year. We would be able to fit that work, this new scope of work, within that existing budget authority.
So we're getting rid of the small-scale renewable follow-up. I'm
follow-up.
Sorry. Small-scale renewable energy portfolio program.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, Representative Brock Smith, the current proposals for the small-scale energy loan program are actually to move them to Business Oregon, with the revenue that it generates and the FTE that staffs the program.
And then, lastly, my original question. Thank you. When it comes to the greenhouse and carbon emissions in the state of Oregon versus the percentage on the global scale, what is Oregon's emission percentage?
Chair Helm, members of the committee, Representative Brock Smith, I actually didn't know this walking up to the table, but it's less than 1%, and I cheated to get that answer, so I apologize.
So maybe less than a half of 1%?
Chair Helm, members of the committee, Representative Brock Smith, I would have to check my math. I don't want to go any further with the cheating right now.
Thank you.
Sure.
One more question, Representative.
Not really a question. I just wanted the opportunity to provide some additional information to this committee on some of the recommendations that came from the utilities and to address some of the inaccuracies that were made by Portland General Electric. And some inaccuracies in their handout as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Holby. Director Kaplan, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2020. And I'm going to open an informational hearing for an update on Cleaner Air Oregon and invite Director Whitman and Director Saxton forward. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
And I understand we've prepared for about a half an hour with questions. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm and members of the committee. I'm Lynn Saxton, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here today with Richard Whitman because DEQ and OHA are partnering to develop Cleaner Air Oregon, our regulatory overhaul to address gap in our current air toxics permitting program. Today, we will share an update on our progress in incorporating health risk-based standards in that program. I'll preface these remarks by recognizing there are other significant air pollution concerns in Oregon, such as emissions from vehicle engines and wood smoke. There are regulatory and non-regulatory efforts to address these sources of air toxics and active conversations about what more needs to be done, bless you, to reduce pollution and meet federal air quality standards. Today, however, we're here to focus on Cleaner Air Oregon, the initiative to address industrial point sources of air toxics emissions. Industrial use of metals, chemicals, or other materials in manufacturing processes can result in the release of toxic air pollutants that increase the level of risk to people's health. Because industrial facilities may be located near communities with lower income levels and communities of color, some people may be more affected than others. Also, children and the elderly may be more sensitive and at greater risk of experiencing respiratory, cardiac, and other health effects from exposure. When people live in proximity to industrial facilities, especially where there are odors, we're experiencing recurring flashpoints of community concern about health impacts. This can create conflict between businesses and neighbors because under our current rules in Oregon, we don't regulate industrial air toxics emissions based on possible health impacts. At the same time, we must acknowledge the importance of employment as a principal determinant of health and well-being. In some areas of Oregon today, we see, for example, more than a third of residents qualify for Medicaid-funded health care services. I provided you with a map today that shows the incidence and prevalence of Medicaid use in the counties across Oregon. Employment has a great deal to do with one's ability to thrive, and those living in poverty have significant health consequences. DEQ and OHA are committed to setting up a program backed by science that is achievable for industry, maintains employment opportunities, and ensures localized industrial air emissions are protective of public health. Since we've presented on the regulatory reform to this committee in the past, I'll provide just a brief background on Cleaner Air Oregon and focus on the framework of the draft rules. Cleaner Air Oregon will reform regulations for what industrial facilities can put into the air. Our current rules aim to restrict pollution by imposing industry or technology-specific requirements on certain types of manufacturing facilities that use certain chemicals. These requirements rely on federal prescriptions that make assumptions about risk based on the size of a facility and the volume of air pollutants it emits. While the current rules do reduce toxic air emissions from many industrial facilities, they focus on facilities with higher volumes of emissions that cover a limited set of toxics and are designed to address area-wide health effects. This leaves significant gaps for smaller plants, for health effects in the immediate vicinity of a plant, and for toxics not covered by the existing program. In April 2016, Governor Brown launched the Cleaner Air Oregon regulatory overhaul. The governor directed DEQ and OHA to work together to modernize our approach to regulating industrial air toxics. Last week, our agencies issued a framework for this new approach for review and comment by the Cleaner Air Oregon Rulemaking Advisory Committee and the public. Richard will provide more detail on that in just a moment. In broad strokes, Cleaner Air Oregon will assess and monitor current and ongoing emissions of industrial air toxics, use science from authoritative sources to set health-based limits on emissions, provide regulatory certainty to businesses, and ensure that the public that government is protecting the public health appropriately. In the next slide, I'll briefly cover what our agencies and others have been doing to advance this work. Here we have an overview of DEQ and OHA's work to engage internal and external experts and communities in the project. And in the interest of time, I'm just going to highlight a couple, but the rest are contained in our submitted testimony. We've sponsored two webinars, Air Quality 101 on Oregon's current program and air toxics permitting in Washington and California. We've convened four technical work group meetings, and in the fall of 2016, we held regional forums in Pendleton, Bend, Medford, and Portland, seeking to engage people statewide to listen to their concerns and to bring this knowledge to our public involvement process. We established a 23-member Rules Advisory Committee in October 2016, and they are meeting six times through June. Next week on April 4th, they will have their fourth meeting. I'll turn it over to Richard to take you through the framework in more detail.
Thank you, Director Saxton. For the record, Richard Whitman, the Director of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Good afternoon, Chair Helm, members. I want to begin by saying a little bit about why we're here today, in particular to give you this presentation. We're at an important point in the development of this new program in Oregon. As I think you know, this effort began about a year ago, and we are at a point where we are beginning to discuss some of the key policy questions that need to be decided by the state in setting up this new program. Why we're here specifically today, after our informational testimony on the program, you're going to have a public hearing on House Bill 2269, which contains, among other things, a proposal for a fee to fund this program. So this is a situation where the agency, in this case Department of Environmental Quality, has statutory authority to set up this program. But needs to go through and is going through a rulemaking exercise in a very public way, and also needs the legislature's approval of the mechanisms to fund this program. So that's a little bit about why we're here specifically today. So where we are at in the process is the agencies, and this really is a partnership between Department of Environmental Quality and the Health Authority, issued a draft framework about a week ago, and that draft framework went to the Rules Advisory Committee, which is a diverse group that's been set up to advise the agencies on this program. The framework is a high-level tool intended to focus the advisory committee and, to some extent, the general public on key policy questions that are going to need to be answered as this program is designed. It's a starting point for discussion. It is really intended to set up the difficult work in the Rules Advisory Committee, where they will start to develop draft language for draft administrative rules that will be put out in May and June, and then will go out for public comment this summer and early fall. So we have a lot of public process, public engagement in front of us, and you're getting this check-in really right at the ground zero stage as we start into this process. Next. So the first question is really, what is this program going to cover? And right now, the framework that's been put out to the Rules Advisory Committee suggests that the program will cover new sources of industrial emissions, modified sources of industrial emissions, and existing facilities as well. It is also anticipated that there will be groups or categories of industries that are found to have really de minimis risk that is so low that they'll be completely excluded from the program. And then the next question is, what's the range of air toxics with a increasingly complex society? We are adding compounds and chemicals almost daily. And so what's the scope of emissions that we're going to cover? We issued a request for inventories from current air permit holders for 660 air toxic pollutants. Those are chemicals and categories of chemicals last fall. That information will be coming in starting right about now and then through early fall. So by this fall, we will have a relatively comprehensive picture of what is getting into the air in terms of air toxics in the state of Oregon that will then allow us to make some informed policy decisions. Next slide. So Director Saxton mentioned this is a science-based, health-based approach to addressing air toxics. So we are starting from the point of view of what is the level of health risk that we as Oregonians are willing to accept in this program? And that is perhaps the key policy decision that members of the Rules Advisory Committee will need to make recommendations on, that we'll be looking for public comment on, and that will ultimately come before the Environmental Quality Commission for a decision about a year, a little more than a year from now. Risk-based concentrations are the scientific term for concentrations of emissions of a specific air toxic that relate to a particular health risk level. So a common health risk level that's used in air permitting around the country is 1 in a million or 10 in a million or 100 in a million. Typically, there are risk levels for cancer, which is a chronic risk over a long period of time. And then non-cancer risk in terms of both chronic long-term exposure and acute, which is normally the health risk created by exposure during a 24-hour period. So for each of those categories of risk, we have from authoritative sources such as the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency or other federal and state agencies, we have risk-based concentrations for about 220 of the 660 air toxics that we asked for information on. Next slide. So the next few slides really just lay out the approach that the framework takes in terms of the general contours of this program. As I mentioned earlier, the first piece would be a set of categorical exclusions, such as facilities that just have such a low level of emissions that we're not even going to require any sort of regular reporting from them. The next category of facilities would be facilities really with a minimal risk, where we have a high level of confidence that emissions in those categories are still well below allowable risk levels. And then finally, once we start to get close to allowable risk, we'll start to require more in-depth analysis and even modeling. And then, of course, we could go over allowable risk, and I'm going to talk about what the consequences might be in that situation in a sec. So next slide. This slide shows in visual form the different levels. So really above all these levels, we have the categorical exclusion or exemptions. Then we have several levels of screening where using very simple techniques provided through the rulemaking process and that provide quite a bit of certainty for businesses, they're able to determine whether or not they have to go to any sort of facility-specific modeling. The intent here is that the vast majority of the facilities won't have to go through that sort of facility-specific modeling. But once we start to get close to allowable risk levels, then a facility would be required to go through first a simplified type of modeling, and then finally a more complex type of modeling. Next slide. Okay, and this slide simply describes the different types of modeling. Again, AirScreen and AirMod are two of the federal types of modeling that are used by US EPA. Next slide. So one question that we often get is, this all sounds nice, what happens if a facility goes through the modeling and we actually find that the risk that is predicted to occur from that facility is above allowable risk levels? And this is another key policy question that's going to come before the Rules Advisory Committee, and then we're going to be looking for public input on, and then ultimately would come before the Environmental Quality Commission. The concept that's been put out for initial feedback by the Rules Advisory Committee is that we would require, if a facility is getting close to or above those allowable risk levels, that they implement what's known as TBACT, or for Toxics Best Available Control Technology. That's essentially a familiar approach in air permitting, where you use for a particular industry type what's a technology that has been found to be feasible for that particular industry. If after implementing those additional emissions controls the facility is still above allowable risk levels, we would then require a risk reduction plan, and we would require that facility to develop also a community engagement plan to work with the community over a long term to try to bring those levels down. One thing that is important to understand about this program is that the risk levels are a function not only of the emissions from an individual facility, they are also a function of where people are in relation to that facility. So if you're in a rural area with a manufacturing plant in a rural community and there are not people residing in close proximity to that facility, effectively the emissions that may be allowed from that facility may be significantly higher than they would be in an urban environment where there are homes or schools or other sensitive receptors that are in close proximity to the facility. So the program is set up to be to adapt the specific conditions of facilities that it is applied to. One of the last things that I want to talk about before getting into some of the practicalities is cumulative risk. This is another issue that's often brought up by folks living in communities that are affected by air toxics emissions. So the program concept that is in the framework would look at cumulative risk from all of the emissions from a particular facility of all the different types of air toxics and come up with an overall risk number for that particular facility. We are also proposing, and this is something that would be fairly innovative in the nation, that we look at risk from multiple facilities. This is a program designed to look at very localized effects of industry. So when we talk about cumulative effects in this context, it's most likely to be facilities that are really close to each other. It's not taking an entire quadrant of Portland, southeast, northeast. It's really getting down to the neighborhood level and looking at within a specific neighborhood, if you total up risk from multiple facilities, what does that mean to a particular block in the neighborhood? So we are also looking at that as part of the program and are looking for comment on that as well. So the last thing I want to talk about, second to last thing I want to talk about is just some of the practicalities of implementation here. I'll be the first to admit that the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality has a lot on its plate right now. So given that, what is really realistic in terms of this program for implementation? I want to be very direct in speaking to that. We are going to have to prioritize by health risk, both by area and then by facility, and only focus on those facilities which we have resources to focus on. That will depend on, ultimately, some decisions that will come before this body in terms of approving and signing off on fees that are going to be necessary to run this program. The program is scalable, and once we have that emissions inventory information in the fall of this year, we'll really be at a point where we can say with some reason how many facilities are likely to be subject to the program and give you a sense of prioritization and levels of risk. So we have set up the ask to be a tiered ask, with an initial ask for this legislative session for a one-time supplemental assessment to finish the program development work required from July 1 of this year to June 30th of next year, and then come back for a second ask in the 2018 session when we can give you specific information about how many facilities would be involved and have the discussion with you all about what is an appropriate level of resource, what's an appropriate level of fee for companies to support this program. So we will be taking a phased approach. Even with a fee, we are not going to get to all the facilities that are close to acceptable risk in a year or two. This is going to be a program that takes some time to put in place. Last slide before I turn it back to Director Saxton. So, as I mentioned, you'll be hearing in the public hearing right after this presentation on House Bill 2269, which has as one piece a proposed one-time assessment to finish the program development work for the Cleaner Air Oregon program. And with that, I'd like to turn it back to Director Saxton.
Thank you. Thank you, Director. In summary, when this program is in place, we'll be able to ensure that air toxics are being appropriately controlled to protect their health, moving from a reactive strategy, which is difficult for citizens, difficult for industry, to a more responsive and informed process. I think I also want to underscore that this program is both a phased-in process and one that is driven by science and knowledge and experience. And I think we have seen in other states where this has been done successfully with no adverse impact to business and employment. And I think there is an opportunity to replicate that here. And we look forward to the advisory committee giving us their thoughts and also the results of our own efforts to compile data. So with that, I think we'll stop and happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for either one of the directors? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, Director Saxton, I'll ask you first. I'd like to get at this science-based approach you're referring to. And are you referring primarily to modeling in that and the various iterations that we saw up here?
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, I think modeling plus the data that we have from systems, federal systems, et cetera, that give us current risk ranges for various air toxics. So we are working with data right now that informs decisions. When we began this work prior to Cleaner Air Oregon and Safer Air Oregon, we were using toxicologists' data and experience to inform decisions. Modeling.
So I appreciate that. What I'm getting is, I think there's a difference between modeling health impacts, but then knowing for certain the point sources of those emissions that could be contributing to whatever it is that we're sensing out there. And I spent a lot of time over the interim working on a diesel work group. And it seemed to me that each time that we got to the point in our discussion where we just simply didn't have very good data about emissions, then the argument pivoted to health-based modeling, where we tried to apply a broad brush to everybody and say, well, because there's stuff out there, we have to do something, but we don't know who we're trying to target, what we're trying to do. So I really hope that this effort is going to have data behind it that actually gets to the sources of whatever may be out there that's not healthy and is contributing to, you know, bad side effects and so forth. So do you hear what I'm saying about that?
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, I understand. And I think that is our intent. I think we are interested in – that's part of why we talked specifically and limited the scope of this advisory committee to air toxics from industrial sources. And we are well aware and that there are other causes of environmental quality issues. So I think we can – we are hopeful that we will be able to resolve that.
And then I ask one more follow-up for Director Whitman. Would it be your wish that going forward that this could be an inclusive process with all stakeholders? And what I'm getting at is I'm sure you're going to be aware there's going to be businesses that are not going to be out of the gate anyway, super supportive of what you're proposing. Mm-hmm. But are you willing to work with all stakeholders to try to get a collaborative process here where you don't have to have an antagonistic relationship with the business community, that they could be supported by those that are concerned about health impacts and health consequences as well?
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, absolutely. There is a lot of fear out there right now on all sides, fear from industry about potential economic impact, a lot of fear in communities also about air toxics. And I do think it is, given that, it is important that we work deliberatively toward a consensus here. So we are absolutely committed to working with both the business community and community folks, environmental interests, to get a consensus on this program. That is not going to be easy, but we have been working in that direction, and that certainly is our objective in developing this policy.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for all this really difficult and challenging work. The slide indicates that whatever we're doing, it is in line with programs in many other states. Have we been behind other states?
Chair Helm, Representative Benz, we have been behind other states. Some of the technical work that was done when these issues really came to the forefront last spring was to convene a technical panel to look at programs in other states. And so we have looked at other programs around the nation. And when we are putting out proposals, even starting points for discussion, we're drawing from existing programs in other states around the country. So I would say, yes, we have been behind other states.
Oh, thank you. The challenge, of course, as you and I were discussing, is where do you draw the line? Where is that standard? And then how do you prove to people that you've, A, established the correct standard, and B, actually measured to assure that we're meeting it? I guess I almost have to talk about cost. The standards, you'll get to them. Convincing people that you're meeting them, you'll get to that. Any idea of what we need to be doing and paying for that we haven't been? Or when will you know how much what you're going to suggest that we do is going to cost? At what point may we anticipate that measure of what we're about?
Chair Helm, Representative Benz, I think the best way of approaching a difficult question like this is to be transparent about what the key drivers are and let the public know what the choices are and go through a good process that is as collaborative as possible to try to get to an outcome. The way I would answer your specific question right now is if Oregon were to take the approach that many other states have taken with similar programs, similar allowable risk levels, we believe that the number of facilities that would be required to go through a full bore permitting process and put in place additional emissions controls. It's a relatively small number of facilities, and that the driving that the cost of this program, if that is correct, would be fairly limited.
Thank you.
One final question, Representative Brock-Smith.
Thank you. Thank you, directors, for being here. You mentioned that you're in the process of rulemaking coming up in May.
Chair Helm, Representative Brock-Smith, the rulemaking really began about a year ago. The Rules Advisory Committee started meeting this fall. Rules won't come before the decision-making body, which is the Environmental Quality Commission, until April of 2018. So there's a lot of process steps still to come.
Thank you both very much for this presentation.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. In committee, I'm going to move now to our work sessions. Hope everybody is prepared for those. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2722. And Beth, do we have a description of this to remind folks?
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2722, you heard on 3-6. It stipulates provisions on condominiums or planned communities governing documents that impose irrigation requirements are void and unenforceable while any of the following is in effect: declaration by the governor that drought exists or is likely to occur, finding by Water Resources Commission that severe or continuing drought exists or is likely to occur, a governing body of political subdivision requires the conservation or curtailment of water use, or the association adopts rules to reduce or eliminate water irrigation use. It also authorizes the association for planned communities or condominiums to adopt rules that require the reduction of certain irrigation or landscaping, the replacement of turf or other landscape vegetation with xeriscaping.
Good.
And there was a no revenue and no fiscal impact issued on the bill.
Thank you. I'd entertain a motion at this time.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 2722 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Power moves House Bill 2722 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Representative
Brock-Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Power? Aye.
Chair Holland? Aye. Motion passes. And we'll assign that to Representative McLean, I believe. Susan McLean. And we're going to now open a work session on House Bill 2954. Beth, do we have a description reminder on this one?
Mr. Chair and committee members, you heard this bill originally on 3-15. There's a no revenue and a fiscal impact issued on this measure. House Bill 29554 would appropriate $5 million from the general fund to the Oregon Department of Administrative Services for the purpose of upgrading the Crescent Sanitary District sewer system, and this does have a subsequent referral by prior reference to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. I'd entertain a motion on this bill.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 2954 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Power moves House Bill 2954 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Power.
Actually, I just wanted to update in case our fellow committee members hadn't had a chance to check OLIS. We did get the report and engineering analysis and cost analysis for the sanitary district in doing their own studies. And it looks as though they are going to be putting in a significant amount of money on their own to help fund either a loan through USDA or DEQ. This funding appears to be, you know, based on my question to them last time, that gap between keeping their rates remotely reasonably financially doable for a very low-income community, in addition to the loan amount that they'll already be taking out. So I feel quite comfortable with this.
Very good. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
A question, unfortunately, I didn't realize those were up and I hadn't read them. Did they indicate in the report what they expected those rates are likely to be with or without this support?
Based on the financial analysis, and it's in the one of the committee documents on page 72, without this funding, their rates could be as high per EDU as $204 a month. With this funding, it's going to keep it at about $60 a month.
60?
60.
Okay.
Which is still more than I know my community pays.
Yeah, if I could simply comment on that, the fees in a city like Cobourg, which we talked about during the hearing, are approximately $100 a month. So we're talking about similar kinds of range. And for a tertiary treatment plant, it's a much different plant than the one they're talking about installing in Crescent.
And off, buried in this report, and you can go back and read it later, they are ineligible, it appears, for several types, or at least one type of grant funding, because their income is so low in the majority of the community.
Did you say they're not eligible?
Correct. Thank they don't you. Make enough money to be
right.
eligible for a grant program.
That's interesting.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be supporting this bill. I definitely agree that this issue needs to be addressed. But I know there's issues like this around the state. And, you know, at some point I do get concerned about local governments issuing septic tank permits without proper analysis to make sure that the soils can adequately handle it. I realize a lot of these are old, but some are new. And so I just hope that at some point we can, make sure that our local governments are getting the resources they need to make sure that we're not putting in too many septic tanks into a particular area. So with that, because I imagine this issue will pop up in other areas around the state.
Very good. Thank you. With that, I'm going to ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative
Vince?
Aye.
Representative
Holby?
Aye.
Representative
Rushkin?
Aye.
Representative
Roxman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Pollard?
Aye.
Chair Helm?
Aye.
Motion
passes. And this will go to Ways and Means, and then Representative McClain will be happy to hear that. Opening a work session on House Joint Memorial 5. And Beth, we have a reminder on this one.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Joint Memorial 5, urges Congress to continue to appropriate funds for the Hanford Nuclear Reservation cleanup with specific focus on funding for remediation of groundwater contamination. There's a dash to amendment available on OLIS that has a no revenue and no fiscal impact issues, replaces the whereas section with language that makes it clear that although there's been significant progress in reducing the flow of contaminants, that expansion of the treatment system is still needed, especially on Hanford Central Plateau, and clarifies that federal funding for the cleanup is not keeping pace with the actions needed.
Good. I'd entertain a motion on this joint memorial. Go right ahead.
Chair Helm, I move to adopt the dash 2 amendments dated March 23rd, 2017.
Representative Power moves to adopt the dash 2 amendments dated March 23, 2017. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Helm, I move House Joint Memorial 5 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Power moves HJM 5 as amended to the floor with a recommendation to adopt it. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Vince?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative
Colby?
Aye. Representative
Rushkin?
Aye. Representative Roxman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Pollard?
Aye.
Chair Helm?
Aye. The motion passes. Representative Holby, did you want to carry this? Was this your bill?
Yes, certainly.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you for doing it.
Very good.
All right. This time I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2236 and House Bill 2269. And I'd like to invite Palmer Mason and Amber Taylor up to give us an overview of these two bills, and then I'll get into public testimony. We've got about a dozen folks that have signed up for public testimony, and we'll try to get through all of you before at least I leave. My committee members need to go on with the rest of their lives at about 4:45, but any of them that wish to stay are welcome to, but I'll stay and get your testimony so you can have it on the record. Welcome.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the Senior Legislative Advisor for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Thank you for having the public hearing today on House Bills 2236 and 2269. I'm going to focus most of my testimony on House Bill 2269, which is the department's air toxics bill, and I will be alternating between the bill and then a dash one amendment that has been submitted. We weren't able to get the amendment through legislative council in time, so what we have tried to do to make this process as transparent as possible was we provided the committee with the information that we sent to legislative council, and I believe it's posted on OLIS. So if you want to follow along with that conversation, please do so. I will make a quick mention about House Bill 2236. That is a bill that the governor pre-session filed, and it directs the Department of Environmental Quality to study the regulation of air contaminants from industrial sources. We are asking the committee to support that bill and move it along so that as we continue the legislative discussion around air toxics, that bill is available for work if it's needed. But again, I'd like to focus most of my remarks on House Bill 2269. And as I indicated earlier, that is the department's bill, and we are asking for your support on it. And again, I want to take you through the dash one amendment and the bill itself. Maybe before I do that, though, to give you a little more context, the bill and the dash one amendment focus on one of the issues that Director Whitman raised in the presentation around Clean Air Oregon. And that is the ask that we are making of the legislature around the fees to support the ultimate human health-based Cleaner Air Oregon rulemaking. As he indicated, what we are asking for is the authority from the legislature to for the fees and the FTEs that are pre-implementation, before permits are actually issued and facilities actually have to pay permit fees. We are asking for the resources and the statutory authority to stand up the program. Yeah. And I'll talk about that in more detail here in a moment. Some other parts of House Bill 2269 relate to diesel. There was some original language in the bill that related to our ability, or rather I should say the Environmental Quality Commission's authority to apply new air permitting rules to existing permanent sources, air quality sources, and I want to talk about that. And then lastly, there is some language in the bill that relate to motor vehicle emission standards, and I'll mention that as well. Let me start first, though, with the dash one amendment and the relationship between that and a couple of the fee requests that the department has in its budget in front of the legislature this year. So if you were to look at the dash one amendment, the first thing it does is it will delete section one of the bill. That originally laid out an approach where we were going to ask the legislature for the full fee authority to implement the Cleaner Air Oregon program. This is both the necessary resources that would be pre-implementation and then the resources that would be necessary to actually implement a permitting program. That is not what we're asking the legislature at this time. When we get to the point where we are close to having a final rule, that first quarter of 2018, we will be back in the legislature asking for the implementation fee authority. So that's why we removed Section 1 from the bill. We are proposing that there be, if you look at the Dash 1 amendment, a new section to the bill. This is specific to the Title V program, which is the permitting program, the federally delegated permitting program for our larger air quality sources. In this Section 1 of the Dash 1 amendment, we are asking for the fee authority to raise fees on Title V sources to fund a new to fund our complaints response program, and it's specifically policy option package 112 in our budget that has a policy option package that asks for two positions that will be assigned to do field investigation and response work related to complaints, principally nuisance complaints that come from industrial facilities. This specific amendment is asking for the authority to raise fees on Title V sources. Separately in the budget, we are asking for the budget, the spending authority to raise fees on our smaller permitted sources, which are known as air contaminant discharge permit sources, so ACDP. And we have rulemaking authority to raise the fees, but we will need spending authority from the legislature to do that. That's the first part of the Dash 1 amendment. Then I'm going to move on to another part of the amendment. This is what Director Whitman was again talking about earlier. And this is the authority to raise a one-time supplemental fee on both Title V sources, again, our larger air contaminant sources, and our smaller sources who have an ACDP permit for the period of July 1 of 2017 through June 30th of 2018. And we are asking for that authority in statute for that one-time fee. And this will, again, go to funding the first part of our program. So in that period of time, it would raise approximately $1.1 million for us to complete the rule development work around Cleaner Air Oregon, to continue the modeling work that we need, the emissions inventory data that we're trying to collect from facilities, and continue this communication and stakeholder engagement. And that would bring us up to the point of going to the Environmental Quality Commission in the first quarter of 2018 for the final rule authority to actually implement this program. And as I said earlier, we would be back in the legislature in February of 2018 asking for the fee authority for those specific fees. So maybe I'll stop there and see if there's any questions on that before I move on to other parts of the Dash 1 amendment.
Committee, do you have any questions at this point? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, Palmer. So I hear you talking about one-time fees, but then I hear you coming back again later for additional fees. So one time, or one time for this session and one time in the next session? What are we talking about?
Yeah, Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, maybe I should be more clear. The authority in this bill, if the legislature were to enact it, is for a one-time supplemental fee. And that fee would only pay for the positions that we need to stand up the program. What we would need to then do is get a better understanding of the number of facilities that potentially are impacted by the rule, return to the legislature in February 2018, and then say, what is the full implementation fee? That would include the cost that were used to stand up the program, as well as any cost of having an actual permitting program. So there will be an ongoing fee
Let's be clear. We're not just talking about a one-time charge. You're talking about standing it up and then ongoing maintenance as you go forward, correct?
Definitely. We're talking about ultimately in 2018 a full fee for the program. I think when we are calling this a one-time assessment, it's a one-time assessment only for the purpose of standing up the program. And then we shift into full implementation fees.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
And then you mentioned larger sources and smaller sources. Can you delineate who they are and how many in each category there might be in the state of Oregon?
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, I can give you some rough numbers, and if I am incorrect, we'll give you the more precise numbers later. There's approximately, I think, between 105 and 110 Title V sources, so again, the larger sources. I think the request that we made for the emissions inventory was about 2,600 permitted sources, so you could subtract that 110 Title V sources from that number. What the fee will be for any individual source is unknown, except for this one-time pre-implementation fee. We do know what that will be, but the ultimate implementation fee for that universe of 2,600 facilities isn't known at this time.
Representative Benz, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Palmer, looking at this, there was a phased-in amount. I don't have your dash one, so I can't seem to find it anyplace. Sorry, maybe it's my computer ineptitude, but the challenge is, are those that are going to be paying for this, is it one of those not-to-exceed situations where the fee will not exceed? Is that how you're setting it up?
Chair Helm, Representative Vance, the way we're setting up is that the statute would actually have a precise number for each facility type. So, and I'm happy to give you more information later, but to give you a sense for what we're talking about, the larger permitted sources would be paying basically a supplemental fee of $1,200 and then an admission fee per ton of the different type of admissions of roughly $9.49. And then some of our smaller fees some of our smaller sources will pay smaller fees ranging from $68 to $728. And I'm happy to give you more information, but just to give you a sense of how that will work. And that will be set in statute, and it's all they would have to pay for that one-time supplemental.
Thank you.
Go ahead and continue. Thanks.
Okay. So moving on to the Dash 1 amendment, as I indicated, the bill relates to other issues. So I want to mention to the committee that the amendment makes some changes regarding the diesel program at DEQ. And if there are any technical questions on that I can't answer, we have Kevin Downing in the room, who is our program manager for our clean diesel engine program. Basically, the Dash 1 amendment and House Bill 2269 aim to ensure that the Volkswagen settlement dollars are available to the existing clean diesel engine fund that we have. That would be one change that we're proposing to make in law. Additionally, we want to update the existing clean diesel program to reflect changing practices among businesses and other stakeholders who want to access clean diesel money for assisting in engine phase out and other engine changes. So we are proposing in the bill to shift more from a retrofit approach to more of a replacement approach, so that we're talking about replacing diesel engines rather than retrofitting them. So that's one additional change in law that we're making. We propose to, in the Dash 1 amendment, make some changes to add an additional vehicle category for where VW dollars could be spent. The bill right now focuses dollars on certain types of vehicle types, including transit buses, garbage trucks, delivery trucks. If we want to include vehicles owned and operated by the federal government or a local government, we are adding the language about the federal government specifically because that's called out in the consent decree for the VW settlement. And then I'll move on to a couple of additional issues. If you were to look at House Bill 2269, there is some language in there that would repeal a limitation on the Environmental Quality Commission's authority. And I want to explain what that does. Right now, the current law could be read to limit the EQC's authority to impose new air quality standards on existing sources and only impose those new standards through a modification of that facility's permit. We initially proposed to repeal that limitation, giving the EQC broad authority to apply new standards to existing air quality sources. That raised some concern among stakeholders. We engaged in a conversation with both industry and the environmental community to try to find a compromise that would clarify the original legislative intent from this 1990 statute. We were unsuccessful in doing that, so we are dropping that section out of the bill entirely and leaving existing law as it stands today. And then lastly, I want to mention that the bill, House Bill 2269, proposes to make changes to the department's authority around motor vehicle emission standards. Right now, the department doesn't have the authority to pursue a civil penalty-based enforcement action against someone who violates a motor vehicle emission standard in Oregon. So that would include things like a company, a manufacturer such as VW, not being subjected to civil penalties based on violations here in Oregon. We are proposing to change the law to give the department that authority to pursue civil penalties, and we would ask the legislature to give us that authority to apply that to anybody except the owner of the car or their lessees. So auto dealers, manufacturers, repair shops, we could potentially seek a civil penalty enforcement action against any of those entities for having violated motor vehicle emission standards in Oregon. Again, we don't have that authority today. We only have the authority to pursue a criminal penalty action against someone for violating motor vehicle emission standards. I should mention, too, before I forget, that Department of Revenue has raised one issue. I think they've been in communication with committee staff, but I'll just put it on the record. And it was something I didn't know existed. Turns out the Oregon Constitution limits how you can apply emergency clauses to tax credits, unbeknownst to me, and requires that legislation be effective 91 days after its enactment date in order to affect tax credits and other tax provisions. There is some language in House Bill 2269 that relates to tax credits. We had a conversation with Legislative Council about whether that language was necessary. They felt that it is. So we may need to amend the emergency clause and have it apply to every other section of the bill but for that section related to tax credits. So, happy to take any further questions on either the amendment or the bill.
Wayne, do you have any further questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I understand that now what you're doing, and I noted the special activity fee to fund the investigation of complaints, and then the key phrase is related to sources subject to. But do we know that that whatever it is we're going to be doing with these funds, that we're only going to be investigating those sources, or is it possible that the concerns that we're worried about are being generated by sources other than those who are paying the fee?
Chair Helm, Representative Bence, that's an excellent question, and yes, that is what could very well happen out in the real world. So what we're proposing to do with this particular budget request is to have two positions that would be funded off of the different industrial permitting programs. But when someone goes out into the field for DEQ, their time is coded. And it's only when we determine that the source that's actually responsible for the nuisance or for the complaint is an industrial facility, and further they fall in one of those buckets, either the Title V buckets or a larger source or a smaller source would be the ACDP, that their time would actually be coded back to or charged back to that particular account. So we feel like we can manage that issue and fairly apportion someone's time to an actual source.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was a little bit confused about your section on the enforcement of emission standards. I think what you indicated was that the rule, the enforcement possibility, this is right near the end of your presentation, would apply to anybody except the owner of the vehicle or the machine, I suppose. Does that include owners who do their own maintenance work or their own modification work? Or have you gotten that far? Is it just too loose grain to get that to that point?
Chair Helm, Representative Barnhart, great question. The way we propose the language and the way it's intended and the way I read it is that the department cannot bring, or maybe I should be more accurate and say a motor vehicle owner or their lessees shall not incur a civil penalty for any violation. So we interpret that to mean that essentially the department couldn't bring a civil penalty against a car owner, regardless of whether they did the work themselves or they're somehow liable for someone else's actions. They are totally protected against a civil penalty. In the circumstance that they've taken their car to a repair shop, that repair shop, though, the department could potentially bring a civil penalty action against the repair shop. But if they did the work themselves, And they tinkered with either the software or the actual emission control devices. The department would not have the authority for a civil penalty enforcement. We could still bring a criminal penalty, but we wouldn't have the authority for civil penalty.
Any questions at this time?
And I should add that in many cases for particularly for first time violations, we often usually only for most parties issue a warning letter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Palmer, I see your proposed fee supplemental fee schedule in the language you submitted to Legislative Council. Will it be possible to delineate or actually identify what fees will be attached to which specific companies out of those 2,600 that I think you mentioned are within the state of Oregon, how much each will be paying?
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, I think we can give you a breakdown of the facilities that fall in each of those permitting categories, and then you can match that to the fee increase.
A little confusing. There's a lot of, you've got probably 10 different categories here. Well, yeah, at least.
Yeah. Right. I'm happy to, if you want, either at this time or subsequent to this, give you a sense of what each of these permits fall, because it does range. But we can give the committee that information.
Yeah, if you can submit that to the committee, that would be best.
Yes. Just one quick follow-up, if I could. You've moved away then from retrofits as it applies to, say, school bus fleets to actual entire bus new bus acquisitions and using the VW money. Is that correct?
Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, the intent of this is to House Bill 2269 is to make it clear that replacement is an option that is allowable under statute for the existing fund. I think what I was trying to say is that we're seeing when someone comes in to get money from the department for some kind of change in their diesel engine, that we're seeing more and more a request or interest in replacements as opposed to retrofits. It's not to say that retrofits can't be part of the conversation or can't be a fix. And I know you and I have talked specifically around the VW money, around school buses, how that may be a very acceptable solution for getting our school buses all updated and as clean as possible with some of the VW money.
Yeah, I'd want to see as much flexibility as we can have there. Thank you.
Other questions right now? Any other thing? Any other testimony?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much for presenting the bill and the amendment. So I'm going to go to public testimony now, and in the interest of getting us all home, I'm going to, again, have to put you on the clock. I'm going to ask folks to keep your comments about 2 minutes if you can. I'm going to try to get folks that are furthest away. Is Marina Cameron and Clint Cheney, are they still here? Okay, guess not. And then Mary Lou Putman and Steve Putman, come on up. Jessica Applegate and Jennifer Jones as well. They're still here. Whoever's ready first could jump right in, please.
I'll jump. Oh, go ahead. Chair Helm and members of the committee, thank you so much for providing this opportunity to testify today. My name is Jessica Applegate, and I live in the Portland area, and I also run a small business in rural Douglas County, Oregon. I'm a member of the Eastside Portland Air Coalition and also an advisory committee member for Cleaner Air Oregon, and I'm here today asking for your support in House Bill 2669 and 2236, and I encourage that support greatly. I'm also here to remind you that we are still in a state of emergency with air toxics in our state. Governor Brown created Cleaner Air Oregon and the air toxics regulatory overhaul in response. It is imperative that this bill be adopted so that we can complete this process that we have started and worked on for a year. As far as I can see, it's a modest fee increase, and it will put the burden on industry and not on the public. I will never be able to prove that my family's health problems stem directly from living in the airshed near Bullseye Glass. But we can prove what industry is doing in terms of making sure that their emissions are tracked and monitored. I believe that DEQ and our state agencies, given the proper resources, new rules, and oversight, want to protect the public environment and also jobs. Please support Bill 2269 and consider the thousands of citizens from our larger coalition of 22 groups that we've submitted into the record as supporting this bill as well. Again, thank you for the opportunity, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Whoever's ready next, go right ahead.
Do you want me to go
early? Go ahead. Chair Helm, co-chair Powers, and co-chair Johnson, and committee members, thank you for today. In the essence of brevity, I'm going to skip ahead. My name is Jennifer Jones. You can find out about me if you want, but I would like to point out that it is tempting to believe that once the air toxics hit the air, they dissipate and become harmless, but the science proves that's not true. The science proves that on an inversion weather day, after two of those in a row, we'll lose an additional 1.5 people to pulmonary or heart disease, fatal complications from ingesting air toxics from diesel and stationary sources. For this reason, I believe that it is vital to the health of Oregon businesses, its economy, and its citizens to support Cleaner Air Oregon and work to curb industry emissions, and that we need to adequately fund our state agencies and prioritize public health and environment. Please do not succumb to the narrative of mutual exclusion. We can have meaningful air toxics reform funded by polluters and have a healthy climate and economy. Thank you.
Honorable Chair Helm and members of the committee, hello. My name is Mary Lou Putman. I was born in Oregon, have family ties going way back on both sides of the mountains, and I own a floating home on Hayden Island. We of the newly formed and diverse neighborhoods of PDX North Harbor Neighbors fully support House Bill 2269. Why? Our neighborhoods are full of, as DEQ called it, sensitive receptors. For years, heavy-duty polluters and their lobbyists have been skirting laws, claiming innocence, making backroom deals, all while using Oregon's airshed as a virtual dumping ground. They do it here because they could not get away with it in Washington or California. And we think it's time to change that status quo, up the ante, and make polluters accountable. House Bill 2269, working in tandem with the other bill, 2669, and Senate Bill 995, is a very good start in reigniting the original intent of McCall's DEQ, thou shalt not pollute. But I have to say, we in PDX North Harbor are very concerned that the two oil refiners, Apes and Orco, will slip through specially crafted, technically confusing legal loopholes again. And we ask that you make sure they don't. Although these refineries are supposed to be closely monitored by DEQ, they have operated without impunity for years. These oil refiners set up shop under the guise of being environmentalists. But they duped you. They duped Oregon. They are the antithesis. They burn vast amounts of contaminated, dirty used oil called light ends to produce even more contaminated products. Light ends fuel is far dirtier, by the way, than diesel fuel. In the process, they emit mass amounts of hazardous VOCs like benzene, toluene, sulfur dioxide, etc., heavy metal particulates like chromium, arsenic, lead, 24/7. Yet lawmakers, DEQ, and OHA have done nothing to truly stop it. And neighbors continue to physically suffer by being engulfed by these carcinogens, and we think that's negligent. We are not anti-business. We are pro-responsible business. And if you can't operate a business that isn't inherently dangerous to the passerby, it's time to shut the doors, period. They need to be addressed with special rulemaking, as was done for Bullseye Glass, and a cease and desist needs to happen. DEQ told us that Oregon can't pass laws stricter than EPA's. EPA told us the exact opposite. So it's up to you, to Oregon, to protect its citizens and the environment with true enforcement. Don't cave in to the lobbyists. Make your grandchildren proud, not the polluters. And we urge you to pass House Bill 2269. The status quo has got to go. But please pass that bill. Thank you.
Honorable Chair Helm and Board Committee members, I'm Steve Putman, Mary Lou's other half. I will keep mine real short just to kind of make up. We've been fighting this problem almost 2 years now. The one thing that I have learned, aside from what Mary Lou presented, is that you really need to question the methodology of how these tests are being done, even with these new Cleaner Air Oregon situations that's coming to light. The methodology is lacking on many levels on the airshed. Their climate modeling is somewhat flawed. I've experienced it firsthand from the standpoint of wanting to collect samples when the wind is blowing the other way. It doesn't work.
Urge them to.
It's critical to really question the methodology. Okay.
Very good.
I don't know what this is.
We've heard similar testimony on related bills. Very good. Thank you all for your testimony and staying to the end of the hearing. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for staying.
How about Greg Thielen? Greg, come on up. And Lisa Frack. Thomas Mosher, and go right ahead.
Start. Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lisa Frack, and I'm the communications manager with Neighbors for Clean Air. In my testimony today, though, I'm also representing 12 other organizations that strongly support House Bill 2269 and urge you to support it as well. When Cleaner Air Oregon was created about a year ago, has been mentioned already, in 2016, Governor Brown intended to do a couple things, assess the current rules, because they clearly weren't working very well, gather expert and community input, which they're still doing, finalize new health protective regulations, which they're on their way to doing, hopefully by the end of this year, and importantly, to implement them. This bill and the modest and necessary fee increases that it imposes on stationary air pollution source permittees represents a critical step towards the successful implementation of the health protective air toxic rules that are presently under development by the DEQ and the OHA in the Cleaner Air Oregon process. For far too long, communities across the state, especially communities of color and other marginalized communities, have been forced to bear the very real health risks and costs imposed on them by the lack of an adequate air toxics regulatory program at our state level. To address that failure, Cleaner Air Oregon will establish a regulatory framework within which public health risks will be identified and, when necessary, reduced. It is fair that the sources placing communities at risk of harm play a greater role in funding the effort necessary to reduce those harms than they have historically been asked to play. We strongly support adequately funding Oregon state agencies and their work to protect public health and the environment, especially in an era like we're in of likely reduced federal support. This funding has never been more critical. Thank you for considering our support of House Bill 2269, and if it's okay to list those organizations that are supporting it, Neighbors for Clean Air, Northwest Environmental Defense Center, the NAACP Portland Branch, OPAL Environmental Justice, the Coalition for Communities of Color, Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, Beyond Toxics, Eastside Portland Air Coalition, whom you've heard from, North Portland Air Quality, Onward Oregon, Clean Corvallis Air, Clean Air Grants Passed, and South Portland Air Quality. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chairman Helm, members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Greg Thielen. I'm a native Oregonian and a longtime Portland resident. I've worked in the Lower Columbia region all my life. I'm technically oriented. For 17 years, I was a licensed journeyman electrician, often in industrial facilities, including chemical, wood products, food processing, wastewater, and agriculture. I've also worked as an educator and a school administrator. I'm nearly retired now, but I still do part-time tech support for our local company in pulp and paper mills. I mentioned my work history because much of it has been spent with materials and in environments that are hazardous to health. I'm good friends with my hard hat, safety glasses, NIOSH masks, hearing protection, etc., and have been careful throughout my working life to use this gear when necessary, to follow safety rules, and above all, to use my eyes and my wits to help me stay out of trouble. I've been relatively successful at this and have thankfully so far suffered only minor injuries on the job. People working in industry know there are hazards because they're warned about them. They're trained to protect themselves. I ask you, if you will, to imagine yourself in a scenario where you haven't been warned about a hazard that exists and you end up being injured or poisoned without your knowledge. For example, imagine living in a home in a quiet neighborhood, as I have for 30 years, raising a family, your daughter going to the local schools, tending vegetables in your backyard garden, the good life. And then one day you're told the air around your home in your neighborhood schools is loaded with toxic heavy metals emitted by a nearby factory and has been for decades. You're told to not eat the vegetables from your garden. All these years and no one has told you to wear your NIOSH mask like they did at work. I think you would be upset. I think you'd want to know who was responsible and try to do something about it like I am, because this is my story. Thankfully, the DEQ was ultimately able to identify and, with the help of the governor, take action requiring the factory, Bullseye Glass, to drastically reduce the toxic emissions. This was last September, which was exactly 24 years too late for my daughter. I believe in progress and I support industry. For me, it has been the source of a lot of rewarding work. I also support the right, our right to breathe clean air. Industry does not own the air we breathe in our neighborhoods and schools. Historically, since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, it has been shown over and over that industry needs outside regulation to operate in ways that are not harmful to public health. Oregonians have created institutions including Clean Air Oregon. I strongly support you to urge you to support 269 so we don't have to worry about NIOSH masks.
Thank you.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Thomas Mosher. I'm here representing the Portland Audubon Society. We're just offering our support on both 2236 and 2269. Protecting the quality of our air is of the utmost importance, and we're proud to stand with the other organizations and the residents who've come to talk about why they support these bills. We do too. We ask that you support pass the bills. Thanks.
Thank you all. Thank you for coming. Appreciate it. Next up, Heath Curtis. Is Catherine still here? And JL, come on up.
Right ahead, right here. Members of the committee, Chair Helm, my name is Heath Curtis. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Forest Industries Council. We represent Oregon's large timberland owners and most of Oregon's forest product manufacturers. And we urge a no vote, at least on the first couple sections, as we believe it will ultimately be drafted at House Bill 2269. That is specifically the fees associated with the air toxics program. In 2016, in the wake of the Bullseye Glass debacle, the governor initiated a rulemaking to try to put in place a new program that would be health-based and science-based and regulate air toxics polluters. That rulemaking has been on a fast track ever since. The governor immediately initiated a rule advisory committee and started holding hearings. OVIC was never invited to that rule advisory committee, but because I thought air toxics might be interested to our industry, I started attending those meetings. As I did, it became perfectly clear to me that what the governor and her staff were pursuing was a program very similar to the South Coast program in Southern California, that is to say, the nation's strictest air toxics program. It was very complicated, and it took a lot of time to learn. But the ultimate question was always out there: what will be the relevant health risk allowable under the program? And that question was held and held and held until last Tuesday, when DEQ published its proposed rule framework. And that framework defines the program to be almost identical to California's program. However, it also includes a cumulative risk assessment program, and it has the lowest in the nation air toxics thresholds. When Director Saxton and Director Whitman stand before you and tell you that it will have a relatively small number of people involved, I don't know how they come to that conclusion. No adverse impact? How do we know? There's been no emissions inventory submitted yet. There's no information for them on which to make that assessment. We would ask you to hold off on funding this program until we have a better idea. We don't think it's fair to put this on the back of Oregon industry. Chapter 468A is a really powerful statute. It would allow the agency, I think, to set a zero in a million threshold for air toxics. And why don't we do that? Because it would have profound economic impacts on our state. You should retain that policy discretion. Please hold on to these fees until we know what this program looks like.
Thank you.
For the record, Catherine Venata, Director of Government and Regulatory Affairs for the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. I've provided the committee with a handout. Ditto to what Mr. Curtis has said about the program, Northwest Pulp and Paper is a member of the Rules Advisory Committee, and I am a member on behalf of the association. The outline that I've given you provides some questions that we believe that should be addressed on the policy side before the fees are adopted. And you asked, what are these fees look like? What's the magnitude? Let me give you an overview. There's about $15 million in fees in Oregon's two air quality programs, and the fee on the table at the beginning of the session was $5 million new money. From industry. And now, because it's been a moving target, DEQ's lowered it to $1.1 million. You just heard that. In addition, and that's just on air toxics, there's about 530 on a position, on two positions for air nuisance, and there's a restoration fee. And in the materials I've given you, it summarizes those, but the 2.7 is now 1.1. So you've got about $3 million in new fees. This is the largest air fee increase I have seen in 22 years of working for the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. It is not modest. It is large. That's one thing to think about. The other is that this fee is retroactive. Anybody who's going to get this fee does not know that it's coming. It will be billed this fall. For your Title V facilities, according to DEQ, 105 to 113, it'd be nice to know how many. We're still trying to figure out. It is going to be a 20% increase. All of those facilities pay about $100,000 to begin with. About $600,000 will be coming from 100 facilities to support just the Title V fee portion of this program. That doesn't include the 4%. Now, you're going to ask yourself, how do we usually raise our Title V fees in Oregon? There's an automatic adjustment clause which allows the fee to be increased up to 3% in line with the consumer price index for the Portland area. It's been this way since 1991 and 93 when the fees were adjusted. It's been adjusted a couple times when they got behind, but it's never been increased this much. In 2016, according to the CPI, it was increased 0.48.
and also about 0.8% for this year. Those were adopted in January of 2016 by the Environmental Quality Commission. That is all the fee we thought we were going, that we knew and we budgeted for as your industry in Oregon at the beginning of session. That has now changed, and now we're looking at 20%. So I would ask you to also look at the letter that I have, that when those fees came up, how many positions were being held open in the program. Early last year, it was 6. Do they need new fees because they haven't filled their positions that they have? We would ask you to look into that. I would also ask you to look at the email that I attached on a brand new committee to work on the ACDP fees. That's about the 16% that they're going to do for the position restoration. And you will see in that email, though it's a little bit hard to understand, you will see that the department in right now, before the program is finalized, wants to put new fee categories on there. And the last thing I'd like to submit for the record is the 85 pages, Heath, please submit this, of the South Coast Air Quality Fee Rules. That is how much their air fee rules are just in the South Coast, of which our program is slightly based on. So start about page 35 to look for the air toxic stuff. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Helm, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing the Oregon Metals Industry Council, representing metals manufacturers across the state. We oppose Sections 1, 2, and 13 of House Bill 2269. Therefore, we oppose the bill. And our position is that the legislature should not increase fees by over $1 million on our members to stand up a program that, in all likelihood, according to our members, would impede operations and likely have significant job impacts in the state, and these are family wage manufacturing jobs. A couple of points that I want to make for the record. First, there are tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars being invested in this type of pollution control equipment already, not just to meet federal standards, but because for many of our members, their orders and their top-line revenue are set in stone years out, and the only way to build margin is to improve processes and technologies, gain efficiencies and things that have a very beneficial environmental impact. And that's how businesses create margin even today among our metals manufacturers. Also, many of our members compete with other branches, other fabrication, other production facilities within their own companies. They have plants all across the country. I'll mention Boeing, for instance. There are many fabrication, machining, production plants in the Boeing network across the U.S. That work does not have to come to Oregon. It comes to Oregon because we're competitive. If we put ourselves in a position where we're not competitive, that is 1,600 jobs that you have potentially compromised. We object to the fact that this places all of the burden on industry when DEQ has concluded that industry is a minor source of air toxics. We believe it sets new standards that quite simply will be unattainable for many manufacturers, and we think it's punitive toward facilities which local governments have allowed neighborhoods to infill. And so with that, I'll conclude. We oppose the bill. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for all your testimony today. Appreciate it. Very good. Thanks. And then our final panel is Marilyn Kennitzer, Peggy Lynch, and Angela Crowley Cook. Whoever's ready can start.
Yeah, good evening. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Marilyn Kennitzer from Corvallis, representing League of Women Voters of Oregon. I am here to speak on both, but I will speak on 2236 first. We submitted testimony to you, and it's in this OLIS system, so I'm just going to say a couple sentences about it. League of Women Voters of Oregon strongly supports the concept of Cleaner Air Oregon to enact new regulations for air quality based on health. We look forward to Oregon's improved ability to protect citizens from the detrimental health effects of air pollution. We expect that the recommendation in the study will propel Oregon to a higher level among other states into the cutting edge of health protective yet fair legislation. We urge you to pass that. And then for 2269, League of Women Voters of Oregon supports the budgetary concepts the DEQ has brought to this committee for their community response Title V fees and Title V fees and the one-time increase fees for Cleaner Air Oregon enactment. We have not yet submitted testimony for this particular bill because we wanted to clarify the language further. We didn't get the amendment. We got the amendment early, but we haven't been able to get it clarified, and I was glad to hear what Palmer had to say this afternoon. Now that we have the draft language, we are ready to work with DEQ and industries and our partners to clarify how these requested fees will cover costs to DEQ. We want to make the fee structure work to strengthen DEQ for the benefit of the health of Oregonians. And I just wanted to say, as an aside, DEQ has been systematically underfunded, as you probably know, for years, and they can't finish their water quality permits. And there are several other things I want to say about this, but no time.
Thank you.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. I'm here to support Marilyn, who is our air quality policy expert on this issue, and as you all know, I do the budget side of things. So it is important, as this bill, as certainly 2269 will be going on to Ways and Means, to say that we certainly support this. We believe that the one-time fee to help begin this program is an appropriate fee. We also listen to industry, and we agree that it should not include the we don't know yet exactly what this program will cost. And therefore, we need to wait until 2018 after the rulemaking is done to make sure that we have the correct fee, the fair fee for all our industries, and to make sure that we finally link regulation with public health, which is one of the exciting things about this. I want to mention something that Marilyn whispered to me when the last testimony was made. The state of Washington has higher fees than Oregon does today. And last I checked, Boeing was in the state of Washington. So I think we have an opportunity here to keep our industries, to make sure we have jobs that pay for employees, who pay for taxes, who pay for the services we all want. So we're not interested in getting rid of industries in Oregon. We simply also want to make sure that Oregonians' health is also protected. Thank you very much for your time. I look forward to working on the bill in Ways and Means.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, thank you for sticking around. This is a really important topic. I'm Angela Crowley-Cook. I'm the Legislative Director for Oregon Environmental Council, and we strongly support House Bill 2269. And, you know, one of the previous witnesses talked about how this is the largest fee increase that they've seen. But let's remember that this is one of the biggest public health issues that we've seen in Oregon in a long time. Oregonians have been breathing toxic air for decades and not knowing. We as the public bear that cost through all the health costs, the days missed from work, and all these other type of things. So we feel very strongly that since there are polluters involved in this issue, that the polluters pay their fair share and be responsible for their pollution. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for sticking around to the bitter end and giving us your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you for sticking around. We appreciate it.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bills 2236 and 2269, and I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Energy and Environment. I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Energy and Environment.